KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
I was 6 years old when they won the last playoff road game, and I'm tired of hearing about it. So finally.
What we do is, we broke ground in the television programming, because now people say, wow, he actually says what we want to say. And we're trying to be funny. We fail most of the time, but we try.
I've had owls that have nested for over 20 years right outside the bedroom window, which gave me a great opportunity to study them, the youngsters, the adults, and intervals.
Tony Angel talking about the birds in his life. We're going to talk to the artist in a few minutes about that. Bassem Youssef, the John Stewart of Egypt, talking about his show before a recent investigation was launched against him. More about that in a moment. And a Seahawks fan talking about his hope, all our hopes. We're going to take that up in the Bernard. This is sausage making. Bernard had an excellent title for that segment of the show. We were calling it the Culture Panel. That sounds as stuffy as public radio could possibly be. Hello and welcome to the Culture Panel. Bernard thought chat room. It's nice. Who's in the chat room? If you guys have some other suggestions, very helpful. I like chat room, Bernard. It's very good. We'll start it with a little. Yeah, right. But let's start with
the verisimilitude.
Yes.
Sweet.
It's always good to have the actual sounds of the chat room. But we're going to start right now with what's happening in Egypt. An investigation has been started against the Egyptian television host Bassem Youssef for insulting President Morsi. Youssef is a satirist. His news program is often compared to Jon Stewart's. He was talking about President Morsi, and he held up a pillow that had a picture of President Morsi sort of silkscreened onto it. And I guess that some people thought that had gone too far. The investigation of Youssef and other members of the media is being called a discouraging setback by the Committee to Protect Journalists for those who are hoping for a freer press in Egypt after the revolution. Sherif Mansour is the Middle East and North Africa coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists.
Well, there is, of course, a continuation of attacks against journalists. I think what we are seeing a little bit more is targeting of anti-Muslim Brotherhood and anti-President Morsi groups and journalists. We've seen a group of investigation that has started by Egyptian General Prosecutor, who was appointed by Morsi in November. And they are all targeting very outspoken, critical media hosts, TV hosts, by accusation like insulting the president and insulting Islam, which we have not seen happening since the summer. It's also one of the trademarks of Mubarak era accusation that we've seen enshrined in Egyptian criminal code, and that's something we wanted to see gone after the revolution. We expected the new constitution will eliminate those criminal charges against journalists for something that they publish. It didn't happen. The constitution actually constitutionalized some of those accusations by recognizing limitations on freedom of speech, including insulting Islam, and making that prohibited under Egyptian law. And we see that as a huge step back to Mubarak era accusations and investigations.
So there was a hope that there would be more freedom of the press under the new constitution. What's actually in the Constitution, what's the language that limits freedom of the press?
So, in the Constitution, there are few articles that generally say that it supports freedom of expression, but there are kind of like limitation within those articles. So, for example, there is an article that says freedom of thought and opinion shall be guaranteed. But there is another article, the one before, says that prohibits insulting the prophets. And that's also a criminal charge that was used against some journalists and recently against one of the bloggers, Albert Sabir, who've been indicted in criminal court for insulting the religion and insulting the president. There is also some articles that in general say, yes, the freedom of the media is guaranteed, but then they limit that by saying that by law, courts can shut down media institutions if they see that they have violated media standards or produced or promoted fake news and very kind of like vague accusations. And these are kind of like articles that deprive journalists from protection under the law, feeling that they are not targeted because of what they write or because of the content of their opinion and reporting.
Sharif Mansour is the Middle East and North Africa coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. So we have Naguib Sawiris. He's a TV mogul. He tweeted a cartoon that some said insulted Islam, but his case seems to have been thrown out. And then we have Tafiq Okasha, who's a TV host. He was accused of insulting President Morsi at a four-month prison sentence. And we have Egyptian TV host and satirist Basim Youssef, who's called the John Stewart of Egypt. He admires The Daily Show. I saw him on The Daily Show once. He's had a petition filed against him for undermining the president. He presented a Morsi face on a pillow and talked about it. Ooh, is he still on the air?
He's still on the air, but the case against him is still going investigation. And that's the problem, is that according to current Egyptian law, anyone can petition the general prosecutor to start a legal case and a legal investigation into a TV host. And under, you know, the current system where, for example, we have a general prosecutor who is appointed by Morsi and who is perceived by many to be his loyal supporter in the government, that gives the president and his supporters, including the Islamist majority in the system and in the government, the ability to target specific outspoken journalists, including Basim Youssef, who has been for a few weeks championing the call to critically diffuse and critically examine the president's statements, positions, and his supporters' attacks on liberal and revolutionary forces. So he is someone who has been singled out, and I think mainly because of his witty criticism of Morsi, his ability to show his contradictions, and using YouTube channels that actually shows on TV things that Morsi has said before he was elected and show the contradictions of what he said before and after, showing the hypocrisy of his supporters when it has to do with supporting revolution demands before and after. So he's someone who has been singled out because of his ability to expose this lack of delivery of the president. And that's why he, for many people, was perceived to be a red line. And if this investigation continues, it's going to cause a lot of, you know, chilling effect among journalists and among media professionals who looked up to him as being a critical voice that may not be targeted. So that goes beyond the regular kind of like investigation to an impact that will cause, if happened, self-censorship and maybe worse.
You know, the Egyptian government has sworn in new ministers, 10 new ministers, including a new minister of communications and information technology. What does this person believe, do you know, and do you have a sense of what direction his policies might lead?
Well, we did not want a minister of media and information in the first place. And this has been one of the, I think, the disappointment decision is to continue to have that position. Since the revolution started and for 4 months afterwards, we did not have a minister of information and communication. That position in itself gives the government and the executive body the power and the authority to interfere in journalistic materials and to create an atmosphere of intimidation to the media. Regardless of who's in the position, this by de facto creates the limitation.
I see.
We've seen that happen once the military government, the SCAF, appointed someone in the position, and when they began that appointment or resumed that appointment, they said that this person is going to mainly work on privatizing media institutions, and they're not going to interfere in political coverage. Few months later, that's exactly what happened. That's what happened last year with anyone who gets appointed to that position.
You know, Sharif Mansour, the Egyptian press was under attack during the revolution, and yet many journalists continued to report. What impact is this new round of censorship or continuing round of censorship, but from the Morsi government, having on journalists? Do you know?
A lot of the people in Egypt are looking up to journalists, and I think that's mainly because they are at the forefront of the struggle. The one result of the revolution that everyone thinks that has been achieved and that so far has not been retracting from is the break of the fear barrier. That's one conclusion. No one now is afraid to speak up and to speak their mind in Egypt. And this has been challenged by the military council. We've seen that happened in the summer of 2011 and even the summer 2012. And if you see our research, there is great documentation of what happened in May 2012 when there was a great campaign and attacks by the military government that included 25 events of assaults and confiscations and arrests of journalists. And they were not successful in silencing those journalists. We've seen that criticism is not going under, it's going above and beyond, and people like Bassem Youssef are not stopping. And even after learning of his the legal case against him, he said, we're not going to stop, we're going to continue what we started. And there is an understanding if that guarantee and that success of free speech and freedom of media has failed, a lot will crumble afterwards. So that's why they are taking the lead, that's why they are in the front, and that's why we are working to protect them and support them in that endeavor.
Sharif Mansour is working to protect them as Middle East and North Africa coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. There are investigations against a number of journalists in Egypt, some people fearing that a freer press in Egypt will not be in the cards after this revolution. This is Weekday.
It's 10:19. In a minute here, Steve talks with artist and naturalist Tony Angel. That's just ahead.
We are a region of art lovers.
It just feels so good. You just can't believe how good it feels because you're looking at something that someone has put together and it's so smart.
I'm Marcy Silman. Every month this year, KUOW and our partner, the Seattle Times, will introduce you to some of the people who are shaping our cultural landscape. I hope you'll join me for 13 for 13.
That starts Monday, January 14th, with a profile of curator and educator Yoko Ott, right here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Community Colleges, presenting the 39th annual Martin Luther King celebration Friday, January 18th at noon. Actor Jim Lucas portrays Dr. King as civil rights leader. Gospel music by Mount Zion Choir. Details at seattlecolleges.edu/MLK.
45 degrees and rainy in Seattle. A new airport is supposed to be opening in Berlin, but now that opening is being postponed for the fourth time. Berlin's mayor is being heavily criticized, and some are calling this whole debacle a national disgrace. More about that in 40 minutes. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
You probably have noticed you're surrounded by birds. They're surrounding you all the time. Naturalist and artist Tony Angel shared his home with the number of birds, shares his imagination with birds, so he joins us to talk about that. By way of excuse, he's speaking about birds and art in the garden Thursday night at Krukkeberg Botanic Garden, their annual meeting at the Innis Arden Clubhouse in Shoreline. Have you been there before?
I've been by it. I haven't been there before.
Innis Arden Clubhouse. Is that a big golf course, Innis Arden, or what is that?
Well, they have a swimming pool and a public area.
I should know that before asking you. It's good to see you again.
Likewise, Steve.
I was wandering in, might have been 6 months ago. You'll probably know better than me. And one of the first Thursdays, and that might even more than 6 months, wandered into a big gallery that had a lot of your stuff in it over on, what is that, Prefontaine Place? Which gallery is that?
This would be 3rd Avenue, the Foster White Gallery.
I'm glad I know where I am. I knew it was Foster White. And there were a bunch of people standing in front of a raven. Was it a raven or a guillemot? Something that was brass and it was turned back on itself?
It was a large bronze raven. Yes, Wisdom Seeker is the title of that particular piece.
And people were sort of reaching out and touching it and rubbing the feather part.
Which is great. I mean, that's why you do sculpture. You want people to encounter it in a broad range of sensory experiences, and touching is one of them.
And they were excited, though. They were like, how did he do that? How did he get it such detail? They really liked it.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I think every sculptor sets out to invigorate or excite a respondent. And I don't know that the detail in my work, for me anyway, is as important as the form and the shape and some of the patterns that exist there. And if they can see that and put their hands on it, or if there is a moment in action for the subject, they can also experience that motion, then that's good.
Where, if people wanted to see some of your stuff right now, where would they go?
Well, fortunately for me, over the years, I've had a chance to place them in a number of public locations. The Civic Center in Redmond has a large 11-foot piece in front of the library there. It's been there about 10 years. A group of ravens looking out in various directions, collecting the wisdom of the world in front of the library here at the Seattle Aquarium, the Woodland Park Zoo, the Francis Anderson Center down at Edmonds. And if they catch the ferry down there, there's a big cormorant there in the little park with its wings out sunning that is one of my bronze pieces. And a lot of interior pieces in some of the businesses around Seattle.
Yeah, I'd like to see some of those. That'd be a good walk if the businesses would let us in. Among his books, Gifts of the Crow with John Marsliff, also Puget Sound Through an Artist's Eye. That's from 2009. Also In the Company of Crows and Ravens with John Marsliff. Ravens, Crows, Magpies, and Jays, written and illustrated. Marine Birds and Mammals of Puget Sound. Blackbirds of the Americas. And Owls, written by and illustrated by Tony Angel. But you're thinking about owls again?
Well, I am. I've never gotten that extraordinary collection or extraordinary family of birds out of my mind, and certainly in the last couple of years where we've had this wonderful infusion, if you will, of snowy owls coming down out of the Arctic. They've been in the news, and a lot of people have gotten out to see them for the first time. Remarkable subjects. I used to, when I was first working on that owl book, this was 1970, 73, when the book came out, I had a lot of these owls living in my home. It just happened. Bird banders would help me rehab some of the birds. Sometimes people would bring me a bird that was injured, and they were in and out over a period of about 10 or 15 years. And then the other side of that is that right outside my bedroom window, I had a pair of screech owls that would occupy a nesting box every season.
Really?
For nearly 25 years. And they weren't the same pair, but some pair or a combination of the two birds would come in and occupy that box.
This is just north of Seattle.
Yes, out in Lake Forest Park.
So what's a screech owl? Let's start with the outside birds. What's a screech owl like to live near? What do they look like and what do they do?
Well, there was a time when they were very common in the area. I have to say that, well, to answer your question, I'll get back to my other answer in a minute.
Were you going to get on the soapbox there?
A little bit.
All right,
a little bit.
That's good.
The screech owl is a smaller, diminutive bird, probably about 9 inches in length, and have a wingspan of something close to 2 feet. And they're great little mousing catchers, mousers, we'd call them. Eat a lot of insects. And if you're anywhere near a stream or a wetland, historically, they were birds that favored that locale. And, of course, they would use a dead or a dying tree that a woodpecker would hollow out as their nesting site. And that's what we had in my location in Lake Forest Park. That particular tree fell down the year that we moved in, and I put up a nesting box, and they immediately occupied it and continued to do it for nearly a quarter of a century. They're gray in appearance. They have a color variant in the east that is red in the eastern screech owl. And we get this western screech owl, the Kennacottai, it's called, that has a brown tinge to it. Very, very subtle and beautiful. But the sad part, for me anyway, is that while you might enjoy the song and the trills of the screech owls in the past, the barred owls have moved in and displaced, to put it politely, the screech owls. And
so the barred owl are not just getting the spotted owl, they're getting the screech owl too?
Yeah. There's evidence now that they're taking the smaller owls that are just simply naive of any big hunting owl like the barred, which is very aggressive, and they're picked off like fruit off a tree. That's the way I would describe it.
Nice image. Have you seen that?
I have. That's what happened in our location, and the owls no longer occupy that box.
Oh, did you see the barred owl come in and nab it?
I didn't see it, no, but you find the castings of the barred owl, and the evidence is when there are a lot of screech owls and the screech owl feathers in the casting, that the barred owl likely has not caught it and ate it.
What did you have living inside?
Well, pygmy owl, barred owl, short-eared owl, great horned owl, snowy owl, saw-whet owl, and, of course, the screech owl. So some 7 or 8 different owls were at one time or another inside the house flying around.
No cage.
No cage.
Do they have perches?
They had favorite perches.
Oh, they had their own favorite perches, the back of a couch or something?
Yeah, they had a couch, but they also liked the top of the curtain where – the other side of the curtain would often require washing. I had a lot of patience.
Your family, your wife, your kids, they must be very patient. What does an owl do when it lives inside, recovering from some injury?
You know, it sleeps a lot during the day, as we remember from studying owls. But during the night, they fly around a lot. And we'd be in bed, and suddenly something would go overhead with a whoosh or a call. And we knew what it was. We weren't frightened about it. But, you know, eventually they were moved to a particular place in the house where they weren't quite as problematic.
All right. When you say eventually, though, how much time?
Well, a screech owl lived in the house probably its entire life. It was an injured bird. It couldn't fly.
So a couple of years.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But again, a perch that we could clean up under, and but it would get around on its feet. They can walk.
And so this bird would be walking around the house?
Walking around the house, yeah. It'd be underfoot, climb up a curtain, get up there, and it hadn't been there before, and suddenly it was there. Yeah.
And could it negotiate? I know that you do not recommend anybody have an owl as a pet or anything else.
No.
You were doing some rehab.
Yes.
But would it, was it safe inside the house? I mean, could it fly easily and not hit windows and things like
yes,
that?
Yes, it was. I mean, the curtains were typically drawn over or something was put on the glass.
Oh, I see.
To discourage them from bumping it. But they had to learn that in some cases. The pygmy owl was particularly aggressive. It's like looked like a big softball of feathers, and it would fly about as fast as you could pitch a softball going from room to room. And the danger might be you'd stand up when it was coming by, and there could be a collision.
What did they have? Did they have particular personality traits?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, like people. They have passive, aggressive, inquisitive, those that are comfortable around people, those that aren't. Sure, they're distinct personalities.
Are there some that you liked more than others?
Definitely. I think the ones that I got to know the best, I was sad if something happened to them. Those were the ones that I couldn't release because the damage to their wings were such. And they died in captivity. And I think that was something that suggested to me that I had a real emotional attachment to them. And in fact, when they see you and they get to know you, there's a form of greeting. Of course, there's a dependency because you're feeding them. And they'll come over.
What'd you feed them?
Well, that's a story in itself. Steve, you know that from previous conversations and visits that things can get kind of gory, particularly when we did a taxidermy moment on
my
show.
One of my favorite parts of the show, and Tony Angel did a little taxidermy for us.
Well, I have to tell you that I raised mice for the birds because they required a good, healthy diet. You don't just go to the grocery store and buy owl food, although you can. I mean, chicken backs and necks would also provide part of their diet, but a live mouse once in a while.
You just let it go on the table?
Well, yeah. If the bird could fly, it was important for it to rehab itself and learn how to catch it. So often the living room floor would be a place of capture.
You would kind of keep it clear? Or was it?
Oh, yeah. We moved the furniture out to the side. Let the event begin, you know, one of those things.
Oh, that's great. How long did you do that, by the way? How many years overall were you?
Well, off and on, I'm still doing it. But that was an intensive period of about 12 to 15 years when the owls were coming through.
Tony Angel is a painter. He's a sculptor. He is many of his topics are the wild birds, crows, owls. The birds, the owls, were they your subjects? I mean, were they there in part so you could study them, paint them?
Absolutely. I think the intimacy that one can have, both to understand their personalities, their displays, their dispositions, their entirety is really important for me anyway. And I think any artist would say, really get to know the bird from the inside out. It's just not the superficial external images. You want to have a feeling about the subject. And that was really helpful. My respect and understanding was enhanced.
So you're working on a new book about this era.
I am. It's been a long book in process. I put it down in favor of some of the other books you mentioned. And tentatively entitled Owl Diaries or The House of Owls. I think I like the latter rather than the former.
Yeah, House of Owls is
the House of Owls, yeah.
Yeah. Because the image after, especially after some of those stories.
Well, and some of those stories and others will be in the book. Some we haven't talked about.
You're teasing us now. All right, that's good. That's fair enough. By the way, did you ever get attacked by an owl? How many of these are wild critters you're walking around?
Well, I'll tell you, that nesting box required cleaning. well, it does.
Yeah.
Their housekeeping duties are such they normally don't have to address that. So I would clean it out every year, and then every breeding season, I would try to check to see how the youngsters were developing. And when the eggs hatch, the adults become more aggressive. And occasionally, one or both of the screech owls would come and give me a flyby. But, you know, Steve, over that time, when the pair got to really know us, there was an identity that they could make with us and a comfortable place that they could be where they wouldn't attack. I could actually go up to the nest and look in, and the owls would be passive about that.
Say, how come no way to have the screech owls in there in that nesting box and protect them from the barred owls? or it's not the nesting box where they're getting...
No. The raccoons, possum, those would be the chief predators of a nesting box, and I watched out for those. But the barred owl will pick off the young fledglings. After they leave the box, they'll stick around the nest for a period of maybe 3 days to a week before they get their wings under them and start to move out of the territory. And then they also picked off the adults.
So you live in a suburbanized mm-hmm. area. Mm-hmm. Was it suburbanized when you moved in?
Yes.
And yet you're able to attract wildlife and maintain their lives.
That's the beauty of where we live, the garden of the Northwest, that we can still sustain and maintain and restore. These species will come back to us or occupy a place. Obviously, the coyote is a very adaptable mammal that we hear about sometimes becoming a pest. But on the other hand, when we plant trees and cover to allow birds a nesting habitat and a feeding habitat, they will come back. And even in suburban areas, screech owls do adapt and nest comfortably.
Real quick before the break, yeah. Why are we getting snowy owls, and what does that tell us?
Well, there are a lot of theories on that. Every year, a few snowies will come south. Typically, one theory has it, the feed for the owls to occupy the Arctic throughout the winter is very limited. So the birds move out by instinct to forage elsewhere to find food to sustain them through the winter. And, of course, most or many of them will return because natural selection selects for that bird that will move out in a short food supply. Established adults will probably drive out the youngsters as well.
Hmm. All right, Tony Angel, master artist, is with us. And because I can do this in a live radio show, he's going to stick around. We're going to bring in Gar Stein and Wendy Sykes in a moment into our chat room, and Tony Angel will stay in our chat room. Chat room really works, Bernard. I'm liking that. And we're going to talk about some other issues, starting with the Seahawk versus the Falcon. This is Weekday. And I will, of course.
That's right, Garth Stein, best-selling author of The Art of Racing in the Rain, and pie baker and pinata maker Wendy Sykes join us next to talk Seahawks, Tullys, and the return of Downton Abbey. That's all just about a minute away. 45 degrees and rainy across the Seattle area. Forecast says pretty much what you see is what you get. It's going to be breezy and rainy all day, with a predicted high right around 49. Overnight, windy, rainy, with rain heavy at times and a low of 45, and tomorrow a lot like today, breezy with showers and a high of 45. The Liquor Control Board is putting together rules for how to apply for a license to legally grow marijuana in Washington state. Several groups made up of lawyers, lobbyists, and farmers have formed, and they're looking to influence the board's decisions. One of these organizations is the Cannabis Business Group, which was organized by attorney Hillary Bricken. KUOW's Ross Reynolds will talk with her about her group and what they're trying to accomplish this afternoon at 12:15 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Evergreen State College in Olympia, announcing their annual open house Saturday, January 19th. Preview Day introduces visitors to Evergreen's theme-based classes and student-centered teaching. More information at evergreen.edu/preview-day.
KUOW 1039, I'm Bernard Ouellette. A simulated trip to Mars in the news at 11.
One kneel down and the Seahawks have won their first road playoff game since the Reagan administration.
We have no desire to be Starbucks at all. So, no, you know, we have a very good plan, and I think the right person will get this, I think, at the end of the day.
Yeah, how'd you find Downton on your return?
Much the same, really. Probably too much the same, but then I don't want to cast a pall over all the happiness.
How could you ever do that?
Let's not cast a pall over the return of Downton Abbey. Also, we heard from Patrick Dempsey. He's not Starbucks. And the Seahawks. So in our chat room, how do you like that?
Chat room.
Is it working for you?
Kinda.
All right, Garth Stein's going to think about that. Author of The Art of Racing in the Rain, as well as How Evan Broke His Head and Other Secrets, and Raven Stole the Moon, is with us. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, Steve.
Wendy Sykes, artist and owner of?
Dale Pinatas.
And the pies?
The pies are on hiatus.
All right, just as long as
I'll still make them. That's okay.
Could you do a pinata in the shape of a pie?
I was thinking there would be pies inside the pinatas. All right, we're going to talk about that.
Okay.
And Tony Angel, I twisted your arm to stay.
I'm back.
Master artist, author, illustrator, sculptor. By the way, I should also say that appearing at the Kruckerberg Botanic Garden Annual Meeting in Innes Arden Thursday night. From 7 to 9, and you can find out. We have a link to that as well. All right, so Tony, in part I wanted to stay because we were talking about birds and Seahawks versus the Falcons.
Mm-hmm.
So in a matchup between a Seahawk, an Osprey, and a Falcon, what should we look for bird-wise?
Well.
And I know you thought about
it. I have thought about it. And unless the Falcon were in a fish suit, the Falcon is likely going to win.
Oh.
Sorry to say that, but the Peregrine Falcon, big, powerful, aggressive Falcon, should an Osprey invade or move into a nesting territory where the Falcon is, that would be the only likelihood that the two would meet. And the Falcon could really give that Osprey a going over and could possibly strike it, knocking it silly. They have speeds of...
We're not liking here. None of us are liking here.
I know. I'm sorry. Well, I'm just giving you the strict bird.
Can we get back to the Falcon in a fish suit?
Yeah.
You like that one.
I think that's the way to go with
First
this.
Of all, the Falcon isn't going to go anywhere. It's just in a fish suit. The Osprey, he only eats fish. And it's going to trot over there and grab that Falcon with one of those enormous... feet that ospreys possess and give it a good squeeze. And they're a much more powerful bird. But the Falcon is highly maneuverable, very fast, 200 miles an hour, and could, in fact, do that osprey a lot of damage.
What strengths does the osprey have, the Seahawk
have? Well,
as I
mentioned, the Seahawk is a powerful bird of prey, just under the size of an eagle, as we know. It can pull a fish practically its own weight out of the water and take it up into the air to feed on a perch. So you know that it can lift, it can grab, it can wrestle. And it does that diving sometimes up to 3 feet into the water and then coming to the surface with the fish to haul it out.
All right. I'm hearing size and strength versus maneuverability.
Maneuverability and speed.
And getting through the offensive line and sacking the quarterback.
I think pressure on the quarterback is the key.
Yeah.
I think if you put the quarterback in a fish suit, I think it's all looking very good.
I'm sensing this whole, can we do a pinata of a Falcon in a fish suit and send it to
it's
Pete
like
Carroll.
A turducken.
There we go.
Yeah.
That would be very nice. All right, how long have you lived here, Garth?
I grew up in Innes Arden, in fact,
all right,
so I'm from here.
Oh, so is that Innes Arden? Have you been to that Innes Arden community club?
Oh, the community club. Yeah, that's where the pool is and all that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Apparently.
Spent my summer days
in the Sargon Clubhouse.
Child, yes.
They have ospreys there too, or fish hawks. Peregrine Falcons will winter there. So we might have a preview of the football game.
There you go. So that means you remember the last time the Seahawks even made it this far.
Yes. Yes, I do. That was my freshman year in college. I went to Columbia University, and I remember that game against Miami with that awesome pass to Steve Largent. That was
Are you excited, drawn in? Is this?
Oh, yeah.
Are you a football fan all the time?
Yeah, I'm a football fan. It's interesting. There's a lot of talk about – in fact, I was chatting with someone just the other day about – the Montero thing, that he's going to be sent back to Columbia for the Sounders. And some guy walked by and he's like, you can't talk about the Sounders. It's all Seahawks now. So I was very excited about that. So,
are you a football viewer at all times?
I am not. Even when I was growing up, I don't know. I was more of a hockey girl.
Are you drawn in now, though?
No.
Somebody, no.
Well, I don't know enough to be drawn in. I thought, oh, that sounds nice for them. That's good. Somebody the other day had on their Facebook post something RG3. And I was like, I don't even know what an RG3 is. I thought it's a new kind of phone. I thought it might have been the mascot or something like that, because I knew this was in relation to the game. And I was like, I don't even know what that is. That's sad.
Are you a football viewer?
Steve, I played football and I enjoyed it at the University of Washington. But I can't say that I'm a fan. It's like I can't sit still long enough to watch a football game. I have followed the Seahawks' very successful season. I wish them well. I do read the sports page, but as a fan, I don't quite qualify.
How do you feel about this? How do you feel the emotion of a – yeah.
Yeah, it's in the community. I pick up on that. I drive to the Y to work out, and the guy I go with is talking about it. And I can comment a little bit because of what I've read.
So you know what an RG3 is or was.
There was.
Not objectify RG3.
The poor man.
Yeah, well, a wide receiver, okay, yeah. No, I – the
he was the quarterback. Redskins.
Oh. Unfortunately, he was wearing a fish suit, therefore lost.
I understand he has a knee problem.
Yes.
And he's out for the season. I did the RG. Technical
now, look. Now, do you feel the excitement in the city as you walk around building your pies and the pinatas?
I felt it virtually. There seemed to be a lot of people commenting about the game on the various social networks. But no. Sorry. Today, like this week, was our new year because we have a kid in school. And so nothing really started until the kid went back to school. Mm-hmm. So I have been doing nothing except waiting for the magic Monday when she went back to school.
How about she? Is she excited about the Seahawks?
She does not even know. If you told her, what is a Seahawk? She would say, you know what? My friend Ben has that shirt. That would be the extent of what she knows.
All right,
Steve, it may be a passing interest that when the Seahawks were formed, I did a sculpture of a Seahawk with a fish, and it was commissioned by one of the original investors in the Seahawks. And I don't know where that piece is.
I was just going to ask you, yeah, where
no
is
idea.
It?
Oh, you don't know where it is?
No, I don't.
All right.
Marty Bean was the fellow.
Yeah. Lamont's, right?
Yeah, Lamont's.
Oh, my goodness.
By the way, Justine writes on our Facebook page, an Osprey is not a Seahawk, by the way, which makes it better, in my opinion, because great legendary mythical birds like Seahawks rule over the obvious and everyday. That's nice.
Wow. Okay.
You have been thinking about why the city is having a crush on the Hawks.
Yeah, yeah. See, Seattle, we in Seattle like our drama soft. And
we like our drama soft.
Yeah, we like our drama soft, and we have a reputation for this around the country, apparently. And we're always accused of being soft, even the Sounders, as well as they're doing. And that's why I believe they sent Montero away, because he's always been a little bit soft. And
we avoid conflict.
We avoid conflict. And now we have this team, and the words they use to describe them are crushing, punishing. They're bad boys. There's something.
Saw some of that on display.
Edgy, exactly. Mm-hmm. They're dark and edgy. And I think that we Seattleites are a little titillated by this.
Really? This,
yeah, I think so. It's in the same way that now, like, you can't buy a book that doesn't have 50 Shades of Grey in it. You know, it's like there's a little bit of this. It's a little bit wicked. It's a little evil. And I think that we like that. Oh, as a culture, you know, there's so many. We're always like smoking weed at gay marriages these days. We want a little edge, and we want, you know, even the Seahawks. You know, I was thinking about this. Sean Alexander. Remember the Seahawks in 2005?
Sure.
Sean Alexander, brilliant running back. What was the one complaint about him? He wouldn't take the big hit. He wouldn't get that extra yard. He would step out of bounds. Whereas if you watched the game last week and Lynch scooped up that fumble and was running down the sideline, and a little defensive back was coming at him, and he could have stepped out of bounds. Instead, he lowered his shoulder and he blew the guy up, and they all screamed, hey, he blew him up. He's punishing. He's a destroyer. I think we're digging that
now.
Wow.
This is, I know so little about this, but I think I might know this. Isn't Pete Carroll a Buddhist?
No.
I thought somebody I know when I was a journalist, they went.
Have
they
to
interviewed
look that up.
Him.
Yeah, we're gonna have to.
Well, they went and interviewed him when he was. Was it USC? UCLA? Who was he? College?
USC.
USC. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. So she interviewed him when he was a coach at USC, and she went to his home, and apparently he was like this. Maybe he is not actually Buddhist, but she said he was the most calm, introspective, Zen type person
she'd
ever met.
Are you sure she wasn't accidentally at Phil Jackson's house?
No.
Yeah, Phil Jackson.
You're right.
Is.
I'm right.
Yeah.
Yes.
He has a meditation master, Chogyam Trungpa.
Huh?
And Zen master.
She's trash talking me.
So
well,
I,
yeah, but I didn't grow up here. I don't avoid conflict.
I think that's very interesting, though, that you – so are we a change – maybe we're a changing
– I think we're a changing city. I think,
oh, that'd be so awesome. Conflict.
How long have you lived here now, Tony?
Oh, gosh.
When did you move here?
Over 50 years, yeah. 58.
And you were born in
– I was actually – I hate to say it, born in Los Angeles, but live.
That's right, you guys are.
Yeah,
I grew up here. I lived here from 7 on, so I grew up here. My formative
60s,
years.
70s.
So we moved here in 71.
Huh.
So.
Huh. You came here like I did.
Yeah, I didn't grow up here.
So I'm.
That's one of my pet peeves about Seattle is there's no conflict.
Well, yeah. Well, what do you think? I mean, Garth is positing that it's changing because of all
the Buddhist,
probably.
The Buddhist is bringing conflict.
The Buddhist, or, Buddhist with a bat.
Or all the all the people from New Jersey who have come here to live. What do you think? Have we changed? Are we a changed region? Are we into a little more blood now?
I think, well, actually, I'll use the football metaphor, becoming more inclined to conflict. I think that to some degree it's good that we step up and conflict. Now I'm going to kind of shift the conversation a little bit to environmental matters, to where we confront them and say, hey, here's the line. We can't equivocate. We can't do another study. We can't appoint another committee or a commission. We've got to take care of business, period. And that's a state of conflict rather than just sitting back and saying, we can resolve this. We'll talk about it. We'll put it off for 10 more years. We've been doing it too long. So I like that.
It's the Seattle passive aggressiveness. You know, my son, my 14-year-old has this theory. He's like, you know, when you merge on the freeway, uh-huh. especially heading northbound yeah. through the Seattle, he always says, just go up the empty lane and look for a Prius. He says, they'll always let you in.
Oh, that's harsh. Garth Stein, Tony Angel, Wendy Sykes are here in the chat room. I'm enjoying that. If you have to come up with, you have to top that one now. Because culture panel, I
culture
felt like
club. You know, a little
culture club
to
is
80s
well, that's not bad.
Music.
That's not bad. We'll play a little Boy George.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you said you found that Downton Abbey. This area is the most. We are the viewers of Downton Abbey. In
apparently,
this
PBS released a press release that said Seattle had the highest viewership of the Downton Abbey premiere of any American city.
Hmm.
And I found that fascinating because Seattle is such a hippie town that can't possibly get out of its Gore-Tex for more than 3 seconds to, you know, put on some decent clothes. And they're watching like the whole fall and the dressing and the servants and the whole thing. And I don't know, maybe we are going for our inner.
I'm telling you, we like our drama soft.
Well, that completely supported your argument, but I thought that was
so
interesting.
There's a lot of cutting going on in Downton Abbey.
Do you think that there is because they're so passive aggressive that it appeals?
Well, that's what I was wondering. What do you guys think? That's exactly what I was wondering. It's a very passive aggressive sort of show.
Well, I think it leaves one of the things that attracts me to it is that it leaves the viewer to the opportunity of filling in the spaces with their own story. To some degree, it sets up the two male characters, the daughter, will she or won't she, the other daughters and their particular choices. I like the way it just takes you. It doesn't answer the question completely. It opens the door for me to kind of go in with my own story and add to it. And I've always been a little bit intrigued with England of this time frame for all kinds of reasons, arts, literature, and what have you. And how are these people existing? And it's pretty authentic.
Hmm. Do you watch it? Are you a fan?
Yeah, I thought the first season was really good and the second season was not good. So I'm interested to see what this season is like.
What was wrong with the second season?
It became very soap opera-y.
Ah. So a little too soft in the drama.
A little too, I don't know. It just became sort of silly a little bit.
How about you, creator of story?
I don't watch much television. I'm afraid I do not.
You're missing out on where all the stories are being told.
Man, I'm missing out on so much, Steve. I don't even want to start counting.
All right, so we're getting more aggressive, but maybe not so aggressive. We'd like our drama soft and the premiere of Downton Abbey. Weave in Patrick Dempsey and Tully's into that, and our fascination with a minor Hollywood star buying a bankrupt coffee chain.
It's so funny. It's like Patrick Dempsey has the rights to The Art of Racing in the Rain, my book, to make it into a film, which hopefully he will one day. And so when this news about Tully's came up, I getting all these emails and phone calls saying, well, you should tell Patrick this, and you should tell Patrick this, and you should. And one of the people I know is Tom O'Keefe, who the founder of Tully's.
Yes.
And he wanted access to Patrick. So I finally emailed, you know, I broke that invisible barrier of celebrity, and I had a little exchange with Patrick, and it was all very amusing. And he's tweeting about ferry boats, and it's just kind of like, you know, a few years ago, we really hoped that Howard Schultz would keep the Sonics, mm-hmm. you know, buy the Sonics and keep them here. And now we're rooting against Starbucks. Everyone wanted Patrick Dempsey to win that Tully's.
Except Starbucks.
So it's kind of an interesting turn of fate. And I don't know if it's a celebrity thing or he's just so gosh darn cute.
I don't understand how this even happened and why he cares.
None of us understand
because,
that part yet.
I mean,
There's still the question of the business.
I get the sort of reference to Seattle because of the show that he was on, but they never filmed it here, right? They never did.
A couple of times they came on location.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
He's trying to be me because my book is set in Seattle.
I see.
And so
I see. That makes sense.
He's trying to assume my life, which is fine because I'd love to live in Malibu.
Keep going on that one.
Warm.
Well, but he was here. Didn't I see his picture in the paper?
Holding a Tully's coffee cup real close to his face.
Right. I think it's the celebrity myself. We are easily swayed by celebrity.
I think there's truth to that. But the fact that that celebrity made a successful series set in Seattle that had a lot of followers, including myself for a season, made it more interesting. And actually made me root for as I would for somebody to buy a coffee cup.
There you go. So that's how it worked.
I guess so.
All right, I got it. I just have to ask this before we're done here. Your piñatas, mm-hmm. Dale,
uh-huh.
are on Etsy.
Yes. Do you know what Etsy is?
I do. But,
okay.
But please, explain it.
It started out much smaller, but it's this virtual, it's an online shopping site. It started out with the majority of the people selling things. They were handmade and handcrafted items. And there's a lot of stuff on there now that are like found objects and vintage things and stuff like that. But it just makes it really easy for individual vendors to sell handcrafted items.
Yeah, it's a great way for artists to get their work
out. Yeah, they make it incredibly easy to buy and incredibly easy to sell. It's
so
really cool.
Do you get a lot of response?
I do. Yeah, I started it on sort of a whim because it's so easy to sell. It's a very easy thing to do as an experiment. You know, you just toss something up and see
what happens.
Is this going to work? And it did. And immediately, I mean, there's millions of people who go there. And It works incredibly well. It was a weird little thing.
By the way, Amina wants to know if you also sell the sticks along with the piñatas.
I don't, only because it makes shipping sort of a problem.
Somebody has to have their own stick.
Yes, you must. It's stick not included.
Etsy, you could be selling your sculptures on Etsy.
Oh, Steve, I that's another story, and I will.
Shipping might kill you.
It does already. Yeah.
All right. Thank you for being in the Culture Club with K's the chat room. Tony Angel, thank you.
Thank you.
Garth Stein or Patrick Dempsey.
I'm selling my personality on Etsy.
And Wendy Sykes, Dale Piñatas on Etsy. Check out the links. They're interesting. I appreciate you guys being here.
Thanks so much.
This is Weekday.
A ruling is expected soon in the Bradley Manning WikiLeaks case. We'll have more on that in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
No, ma'am, said Ed firmly. I'm a grown horse, and I don't want my mind or my morals improved.
The famous Mr. Ed. This week on Selected Shorts from PRI, Public Radio International.
That's tonight at 10 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting Hedwig and the Angry Inch, a co-production with Balogun Theatre starring Jarek Hoffer, live at the Moore Theatre January 15th through the 27th. Tickets available now at stgpresents.org.
Many people say there is a heaven, but not many of them are academic neurosurgeons like Eben Alexander. But Alexander, a scientist, had a near-death experience he says gave... Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.